Good afternoon, this is Gary Kavanagh here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. Here are today's stories. It's actually a very busy day. When we're recording this, there have just been reports that Iran has started to fire at least a dozen missiles at two different US military bases. Absolutely no idea what will happen there. We're not going to really discuss it because by the time this goes live, America has probably responded and several Iranian cultural sites could just be rubble. So we just, that's why we are not talking about what will probably be the biggest story of the day.
And we're not going to talk about the fact that Iranian fighter jets are apparently now entering into Iraqi airspace, just to make the fuss even more fun.
So reports are now saying, but those reports I think are unconfirmed, where the missile strikes have just been confirmed by the Pentagon.
It's all good stuff.
I mean, it's a great time to be alive, Michael, not being under Iranian missile attack or the subsequent American missile attacks.
Absolutely. And it's Orthodox Christmas as well. I mean, it's just going to spoil it for everybody.
Just after, we did miss Little Women's Christmas, so that was nice of him.
Indeed. Yeah, La Befana.
There are reports that apparently the Iranians tried to hit the structures of the two bases and not cause casualties, in the idea that this would apparently cause the Americans not to retaliate.
Well, these are de-escalation strikes, of course.
It's very hard to do a de-escalation policy through active missile strikes.
You have to be double jointed to pull it off. I don't, Trump, God knows what goes on inside that head, I suppose, but I've always had the feeling that he was instinctively, let's not go to war, because that really has been very messy and cost too much money and really hard to win.
I do quite like his policy of let's just assassinate all of their top people. It's a real revolution in war. It's no longer about soldiers, just shoot all the commanders.
Well, you could consider him a walking command and control centre.
One certainly could. Anyway, here are today's stories. The first story I've got to say gave me a level of joy I haven't felt in years. Because, you know, Michael, in politics and in life, you just get jaded. Things, you know, sometimes things just meld together. Nothing seems to be really different or unique. And you feel like you've seen it all, or you can at least tell where everything is going. But the Irish government recently did something I didn't expect, and it was absolutely miraculous, because I incredibly enjoyed it. The Irish government, the Fine Gael government, at a time when they seem to just be going from scandal to scandal, everything is going wrong, the health service is collapsing, record levels of homelessness, and they decided that what they really needed to do, what would really just bring them up in the polls, was to announce a commemoration of the RIC.
Yes, and the DNP.
You may remember as a group that was, shall we say, linked to the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries.
There were definitely links, yes, I think it's fair to say that.
Strong, immediate links. So that, I think, was a great thing to see, something totally unexpected in politics. And then we also want to talk about Ricky Gervais and his hosting of the Golden Globes. I think it's being talked about an incredible amount. He pretty much just laid into the people in the Golden Globes as useless, pointless hypocrites.
There was a very definite sense of Ricky saying, I'm not going to be invited back.
And I have enough money that it doesn't bother me if you don't invite me back.
He is a very, very wealthy man. And he doesn't seem to care.
But let's go to the RIC thing, Michael.
Now, you said that this was something very unexpected. I have to quibble there, because to say that an extraordinarily ill-thought-out idea with no apparent political upside to it being launched in the teeth of an upcoming general election by this government is unexpected. I think precisely what I expect of them. I will admit, I was talking to our friend and colleague Paddy Manning about this the other day, and I said the thing about it is, it's not that they've come up with a really bad idea. You'll give them that. But there's a saying in Italian, when you want to kind of express exasperation at a friend or a member of the family who has found yet another way to screw you over or to screw themselves over, you say, God, it's like he goes out with a lamp looking for it. This particular idea, you had to go out with a lamp to look for it. This was not in the air. There was no chatter. There was nobody in the back pages of the Irish Times for the last couple of months running a little low-key campaign. We should remember the RIC. Let's remember the DNP. I haven't heard anybody talking about there. And then out comes Charlie Flanagan and our dear leader with his announcement that there's going to be the state is going to commemorate the DNP and the RIC. And then they got kind of hurt and surprised and amazed that there was all this very bad, negative, immature reaction.
I think the surprise was my favourite part. And the sort of, well, I mean, this shows we're not ready for difficult conversations. I loved Flanagan coming out and saying, well, no one is suggesting a commemoration of the Black and Tans. We're just commemorating the group that they were technically part of, which is an entirely different thing.
Absolutely, entirely different.
And then they came out and said, well, you know, this was what was recommended to us. The Expert Advisory Group, which is a group of historians who's been advising the state on what it should commemorate over this decade of commemoration, which was a bloody terrible idea to begin with. Although there are some good people on the Expert Advisory Group. Charlie Flanagan came out and said, well, we're doing this because they recommended it, which led the Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, Dermot Ferriter, come out and say, no, we didn't. We're not going to be used as a mudguard here. Now, what he actually told the minister was deeply confusing, so I can see why they thought that. They said that consideration should be given to the organisation of specific initiatives to commemorate the RIC and the DNP and to acknowledge their place in history, which would seem to say that the Flanagan actually has an argument. But then when Ferriter talks about it, he kind of goes, well, we meant like an academic conference. Or like a round table or something to discuss it.
A conversation, if you wanted. And even if you're going to not do something as reasonable or as indeed anodyne as that, does he use the word specific in the statement? The advice. I think the advice used the word specific in regard.
Yes, specific initiatives.
Now, to me, that's from a historical point of view. I think that's for start. From Ferriter's point of view, that's an important word. Because what they're not saying is a generalized, undifferentiated commemoration of these organizations. They might be suggesting, for example, the DMP was originally founded by Sir Robert Peel and was the prototype going on to lead to the police. So you might have a day to commemorate the establishment of what was the oldest police force of its kind in the world, maybe after a certain fashion.
And I believe it was an unarmed police force as well, for the most part.
The DMP was unarmed, yeah. The RIC was armed. And the RIC was the only armed police force in the United Kingdom, really. Although it's also true to say that the Victorian police were more armed than, say, the police of the 20th century. But basically an unarmed police force in Britain, whereas police force in Ireland wasn't. What I've enjoyed, take the word with the salt I intend, is the reaction of a certain group of people, some predictable, some not so predictable, some indeed friends of ours, coming out and getting all annoyed with the likes of Micheál Martin and Fianna Fáil and the Shinners, who are upset at this notion, and saying, oh, this is it. This just shows how the lack of maturity of people. Oh, we only have this single view of history, and you know that we have this notion that all the people in the IRA were all heroes, even though they did some very horrible and bad things, and that we're hundreds of years away from the possibility of really being able to deal with a united Ireland because we have no understanding of unionists or union or their idea, which again I think is really quite missing the point, possibly deliberately, possibly not, because I think we are far farther down the line about understanding the various cultures and traditions and commemorations and memories, shared and different memories and narratives that people have on the island. But toleration and pluralism is about all the different people being able to go off and do their own different thing. And everybody else saying, fine, that's grand, good luck to you. When I choose not to celebrate or commemorate that, I'm allowed to do that too, without being described as some kind of a bigot or historical ignoramus.
And I did, like, when Flanagan came out with his statement before, he's now announced that this will be deferred, not cancelled, deferred, and he hopes that it will keep going. Mm. His initial statement did attack the people who'd said they weren't going, as chasing headlines.
Chasing headlines? God forbid! Chasing, because Charlie would not do that. Charlie is not doing that.
Did you see Sean Fleming, the Fianna Fáil TD? He announced he wasn't going to be attending this by tweet. Do you see that? Did you see his tweet?
No, I missed that. I saw several, but I didn't see that.
It just said, I will not be attending the ORIC commemoration for all of the very obvious reasons.
I was asked by a couple of Fianna Fáilers my opinion and, you know, about a way of reacting to it. And I said, my only point was to say that I would be very careful to say that I wasn't going. Because already when this was going on Sunday, this discussion had started, people on the, shall we say, the pro-commemoration side were talking about boycotts. And boycott everywhere, but especially in Irish history, has obviously a particular load, political load that comes with it. And I think it was important for most, and that was most people said, they didn't say, I am boycotting this event, which is to make a political or moral statement about the people who are going to it, but rather say, it's not for me. I like my commemorations greener, perhaps, or more Republican, or more Bowden's Towny than this, so I won't be going. But have a lovely time. Enjoy. And this, no, listen, just one more general historical point about if the period 1918 to 1922, if that had never happened, and we weren't discussing about that, the role that the IRIC as an institution played in wider Irish society in the 19th century would have, if in my opinion, left it open to rather serious concern whether or not it was something we wanted to, in any sense, positively commemorate. I mean, the policy of coercion in the island, which was pursued in the 19th century, was pursued principally with support of the RIC. It was the RIC that would go during the land war, and they would help get the people off the land and make sure that the gable ends were knocked down. And before that, I'm not sure were they involved with the tithe proctors of the RIC had been established. I'm not sure, but they were. They weren't a great friend of the poor and dispossessed and powerless mass of the Irish in the 19th century anyway. So why did they think that this was a good or necessary thing to do, really?
I mean, I did see a couple of people, mostly Fine Gael people, saying that, 20 years ago, actually I think this was Leo, 20 years ago people hated the fact that we were thinking about commemorating Irish people who died in World War One.
That's not true.
But even if it was, there's still a difference there between people who went to fight in World War One, many of whom would have fought because of the promise of a free state, and fought against, in effectively an imperial war, against imperial power, both of whom were aggressors, versus people who were involved with an indigenous police force controlled by that imperial power.
I think you're absolutely right, but just on the point of the war, I think that there is a point I want to make there, because it seems to me that this is part of a narrative that we've been living with for this whole period of the decade of commemorance, and with the breakout of the First World War and the Somme. And there's this narrative that was being sold that for years and years we never commemorated the First World War, and we didn't talk about all those men who had gone to the First World War and had died in the trenches. And it was a silent nation that pretended it didn't happen. That's just historically a nonsense. All through the 1920s and 1930s, there were commemoration dinners, memorial dinners and regimental dinners. There were marches and there were parades. There were commemorations. The war memorial at Island Bridge in the Phoenix Park, designed by Lutyens, which is absolutely beautiful. If you haven't been, you should go, particularly when the rose gardens are in bloom. It's absolutely gorgeous. Was finished in the 1930s with money found by Eamon de Valera in order to finish the job because they'd run out of money to do it. And De Valera got state money to finish that job. Simply not true. What happened? The reason we stopped commemorating the First World War was principally the Second World War happened, and we started talking about that instead. But you're absolutely out. Redmond came to Wooden Bridge, a few miles from my home, and made the very famous speech to the volunteers: "Go out to Belgium, fight for plucky little Belgium, fight for the freedom of small nations, and by doing that, we will earn our own freedom here." So there's a substantial difference. There's a substantial difference between a chap signing up to the RIC in 1890 because he wants a job, and there's not much going, and his job principally is stopping people who don't have a light in their bike or poaching salmon from the river. But if you're still in that job in 1920 and you're actively working hand in glove with groups like the TANs, like the auxiliaries, and that did happen, and it happened in many cases, then you are now a different part of the narrative, which is the narrative of the independence of how this nation becomes independent. And it was a war, and horrible things happened, and horrible things happened on both sides, yes. If I can tell you one of the stories that I know you absolutely adore from my family history, my grandfather had thought about joining the police, but knowing that it wouldn't be quite acceptable, even in the 1890s in Clare, to join the RIC in his family, he thought about going abroad to either India or to China or South Africa and join the colonial police out there. His parents were fine with it, so he went to get the opinion of his granny Healy. The Healy's were all Fenians. And he wanted her blessing. He was very close to her, and he asked Granny, what did she think? And Granny's response was, "Well, Mark, you can do what you like, but do not deceive yourself. It will be the Queen's uniform you are wearing wherever you are." Now, the point of that is that it was never not political in Ireland in the 19th and early 20th century to wear a uniform with the badge on it. Whatever people's opinions, generally speaking, why these two institutions? I mean, why not the civil service? Why not the Royal Lifeboat Association? I mean, or the Royal Dublin Horse Show? I mean, there are lots of institutions that we have still today in the state, which were part of our previous relationship with our neighbours next door. I'm baffled. Why did they think that this was going to be just an easy, a happy thing?
There are really interesting things about the RIC, like the fact it was a majority Catholic organisation.
Yes, but
and there are things that happened to RIC members that were done to RIC members.
The constables were 75% Catholic, but the officer of the corps, if I remember well, was 70% Protestant.
Yeah, the officer corps was strongly Protestant.
It was sectarian. It was a sectarian organisation.
But, as I said, I do think there are interesting things about the RIC. It is definitely suitable for an academic conference. There's lots there about Irish history that could be done.
Yes.
But the fact that they announced it, and then they didn't seem to realise that when they said RIC, people would immediately go to the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, who, despite the fact that they existed for less than 2 years, managed to actually get a worse reputation than the Black and Tans.
Yeah.
Which is actually pretty impressive.
Yeah, they were... even the opinion of British politicians and British military authorities here of these groups was incredibly low.
I mean, there's the old... I have seen the Fine Gael people, and they've kind of been saying, look, this is not what we intended. It was not going to be about them. And there's the old political saying, it doesn't matter what you say, it matters what people hear. And sometimes you'll say things and people will just take them wrong in a way you couldn't predict. But there is no way you could consider an RIC commemoration and be totally surprised that people just go, oh, the Black and Tans. Also, if you were like a Fine Gael councillor or a Fine Gael TD running for election,
yeah,
and things are going badly, would you not just look at this news and be like, oh, so now we're commemorating the Tans?
Yeah.
Great. That's what this election needed.
That's what. I'm sure the Fine Gael candidates, for example, in Louth and in County Wexford, will be waiting with bated breath for the rehabilitation of Cromwell.
Cork.
Cork, I can tell you. Cromwell goes down very well in Wexford.
I would love to be like a Fine Gael candidate in, let's say, Cork, though.
Yeah, Cork or Bandon, yeah.
Yeah. You just,
My granny's house was burnt out twice by them bastards.
What was it? Was it the Loughnane brothers who were executed by being forced to swallow a grenade?
Have you seen the photograph?
Yeah, I popped up. It popped up today. I hadn't seen it in years.
Oh, God.
Yeah. For those who don't know, they were brothers who were tortured by the RIC. The RIC cut off their fingers and then executed them by forcing them to putting a grenade in their mouth and basically pulling the pin. And there's a photo from the funeral where one of the brothers, they've opened the casket, or given the state of his body, perhaps it would be better to say a rather small box. Because it turns out that being killed by swallowing a grenade is pretty spectacularly destructive to the human skeleton.
You can't say, and it's stupid for them to say, oh, we did, that's not what we meant. Because they said they were going to commemorate the RIC. They didn't at any. They didn't say we were going to open up a discussion about recognizing those many ordinary men who did a job and were not part of anything that was heinous or nasty or bad and helped maintain an order in the country at whatever. Now, I still think that would have been a very odd choice to make anyway. Just to be reconciled to your history and to the fact that other people have different histories does not demand that everybody celebrate everybody else's story. You don't, to defeat sectarianism in Glasgow, you do not have to have every Rangers fan supporting Celtic and vice versa.
But this it used to be a thing that tolerance of difference was a virtue. And then people started saying that, well, if you only tolerate something, that means you hate it.
Yes.
And tolerance is therefore no longer a virtue. And when you start running into things like this, you start seeing that tolerance is actually quite a virtue. Because everyone is not going to like everything.
Also, I mean, I don't want to get into this. I don't want to build too great an edifice over the way people say things, you know, in passing. But I've noticed several comments talking about individual members of the RIC who were killed during the War of Independence, and referring to the fact that they were Catholic. Now, why is the fact that they were Catholic relevant? I don't see that the crime would have been less if the man had been a Protestant. If the man was killed in a way which was vicious, then he was killed in a way which was vicious. If he was murdered, he was murdered. I don't see the fact that he was a Catholic makes it any more horrid or shocking. And just from a historical perspective, it's worth pointing out that it was the policy which didn't always work out in practice, because that's the nature of human conflict and the nature of that conflict, certainly. It was the policy to avoid, in all circumstances where possible, the killing of members of the RIC. That was the policy of the IRA during the conflict.
Now, having said that, there were some pretty horrific killings of members of the RIC.
There were, but not. It sounds like a horrible weasel thing to say, Gary, but in the context of war, there were horrible things, but not that many. I mean, it's not like you're talking about huge threats. There are horrible things that happened. There were horrible things happened to the Loughnane brothers. Later on, during the Civil War, there were horrible things happened to the irregulars as well.
Mm.
If you give certain human men power and legitimize their right to commit violence, then certain human men will do horrible things. Now, I remember my uncle Bill talking about Dan Breen, who was a hero for some, but Dan was not, even within the IRA and within certain elements of Fianna Fáil, not universally regarded as a great guy. Some people regarded him as a cold-blooded killer who enjoyed the killing rather too much. And I remember Bill saying he met him at an army do in some kind of a commemoration in Dublin in the 40s after the war. And he said it was interesting. The guy sat by himself. The old guys didn't go near him. Most of these men were ordinary men who didn't like killing. They agonized over it. They hated it. We know this from the letters, from the conversations, and from their own words afterwards. There were people who did horrible things, yes. But anyway, to me, let's leave aside the debate about that, because that's not what we're here. I still go back to the very first point where we started. If this is a window into the political planning and strategy making of Fine Gael right now, when we think we're going to see an election in the next, 3 months, I wouldn't be running down the bookies to put money on Leo being Taoiseach in June, put it that way.
I will say, if I was a Fine Gael candidate, I would be deeply worried by the fact that not only do they keep doing things like this, although this is a new one, This is a new level. But then, when it goes badly, as it was obviously going to go, they seem surprised, as if they never even thought such a thing could happen.
Yeah.
Like, they did legitimately respond to this with a sort of confused, sure, what's the problem, lads?
But is that not really just a manifestation of something I've said to you before? Which is, in the last number of years, Fine Gael, this tendency to... We imagine them sitting in a little room having a cup of tea, and somebody says, do you know what we should do? You know, we're having all these commemorations and everything, and we're all being nice, and we have the unionists down, and we have the Orange Men to tea in the Arras. We'll have a commemoration. And they all go for the RAC. Oh, yeah. And they say, that, I tell you, The Irish Times will give us a lovely story on that. And the Independent will give us front page news. Yeah, we'll do that. And they never think, okay, but is there any other side to this? Or would there be another story on the second day? Nobody seems to be sitting there going, hold on a minute, lads. Just hold on. Can we just think this a minute now? I mean, they are supposed to have some of the oldest, wisest political heads in the country, in that party. Where are they? Really, was this that hard to predict?
Apparently so. But it shouldn't have been.
No, it shouldn't have been.
Anyway, on to Ricky Gervais at the...
It's far more important and serious.
It's definitely more serious. So, those who don't know, Ricky Gervais recently hosted the Golden Globes for the fifth time, I believe. The Golden Globes being an award show for TV and movies.
And dare we say the last time?
I mean, he kind of tore into the people there. But at the same time, you sort of know what you're getting with Ricky Gervais. And this is the fifth time he's been there. It's not the first time he's insulted them.
No, but it's the first time they didn't laugh.
I will say this. The Golden Globes, I think, is largely an irrelevant cultural institution. But the recording of Gervais' opening speech was the quickest growing video on YouTube. It was number one on trending. It was racking up massive views. So there's the thing. Yeah, he attacked them. But on the other hand, probably drove the ratings up substantially.
Yeah.
So, what do you want? If you want a host who's going to make your award show more successful, that's what he did.
Yeah, I can see. I mean, there's a practical, commercial side to it. Yeah.
Also, there is a great safety in some of the things he said, in that while they were unpopular with the crowd, they attacked them as a group. He never pulled anyone out individually.
Yeah, he didn't even do it in such a way that while he wasn't naming someone, you could pretty well guess, oh, by he means X or Y. It was very general.
Yeah. Now, I mean, some of the stuff was quite pointed, but there's a great safety in being in a group, so you might get momentarily embarrassed, but you're not going to have headlines about yourself particularly the next day.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get drunk, you laugh it off. The things go up. Now, I did like when he was giving his opening tribute, he basically said, don't come up and make a political speech because you people don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. What was the line? So he had, to be fair, some decent lines. Most of you have spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg.
So come up, take your little award, thank your agent, thank your God, and fuck off.
My favourite line was the bit about, you know, the bit where they do this in award shows, where they remember the people who have gone, who've passed over in the previous year.
Oh, and he refused to do it because it wasn't diverse enough.
I looked at it, and I just looked at the other people who died and said, not diverse enough at all. Which is actually a very clever line and very funny, I thought. He was
He is being attacked. Like, the right-wing press are just... and actually the left-wing sort of anti-elite press, I would say, are sending the thing all over, because it does take some hits in Hollywood. And then the more sort of progressive and socially elite newspapers are saying it was a terrible showing and he overshadowed the awards and it was terrible. It is showing an interesting thing across the left and the right, that it is the more anti-elite groups on both sides are loving this.
There was some stuff on Twitter which was joyful. People genuinely trying to make out that just because they were actors and famous and very rich did not mean that they were privileged and could not be victims.
Mm.
And I was saying, yeah, lad, you're if you're straining so hard, you're going to dislocate your shoulder with that one.
It was, I will say, I people have been describing it as hilarious or not hilarious, largely based on political views. I think some of the lines were quite good. And also, these are people who probably do need taking down several pegs. Didn't think it was terribly funny.
It was very much a curate's egg, funny in parts. I was saying to you before we talked, I think that probably it's harder to be funny when you're not getting a bounce from the audience, and he wasn't getting much bounce. And I don't suppose he expected it. Gervais is a talented guy. I don't like his public persona. He does that style of embarrassment comedy, which one of his great heroes was Gary Shandling, you know?
Mm.
Who did the Larry Sanders Show, which is one of my top five shows of all time. Fantastic show. And The Office is based on that. I never can work out, and maybe this is a tribute to Gervais, that, you know, when he does this postmodern, post-PC, risky comedy, when he plays around with, you know, things like disability and race and handicap and stuff like that, and he plays around, but apparently in this postmodern self-conscious way, which means it's okay. I'm never sure if it really is okay or if it's actually just a guy going for a cheap laugh, and that actually the audience that's laughing isn't really laughing in this intelligent postmodern way. They're just laughing at an old-fashioned cripple joke.
I don't know. It's worth watching. The video is on YouTube. It's what you were saying there about him not being invited back, I don't think there's ever a point where he goes so far that they would actually have a problem with him coming back. So, for instance, yeah. Tim Cook is in the audience. Apple have expanded into TV and film.
Yeah.
And he makes a point about Apple using sweatshops.
Yes.
And then he moves on immediately. Now, had he stayed on that point and had he just hammered that, then I think he might not get invited back. But, you know, you make your point, you move on, and everyone just sort of forgets it.
But then it doesn't feel like it's personalised. He made a deal, he made quite a nice line when he said, talking about all the streaming sites and people taking moral stands. He said, for God's sake, we all know if ISIS was running and decided to set up a streaming production site, all of your agents will be ringing it tomorrow.
And he did have, he had an Epstein joke in there as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Got a Weinstein joke in there.
No, it was, yeah, but as regards jokes per square foot, it wasn't the Gettysburg address, but it was a bit of fun.
It's become so political, though. I saw it and I was like, it's the Golden Globes. And then just this endless churn of think pieces about it, and media on all sides. We've had US senators come out and defend Gervais from attacks.
There's always the risk that we invest meaning in things that are really not that meaningful and don't really bear that much interpretation. I wonder if this is interesting in that it's symptomatic, or he's surfing on a feeling, which is important in American politics anyway, of a disenchantment and a disengagement with the elites in politics. And that's important. That's good news for Trump, because they're his folk. And also, is it also possibly part of that sense that the political influencer power that the movie stars, rock stars used to have or appeared to have is basically less and less relevant?
Do you know who I'd actually love to see host the Golden Globes?
Who that?
Doug Stanhope,
the name familiar? I can't place a name on him. Remind me.
He's a comedian.
Yeah.
He turns up. Charlie Brooker did some stuff with him on some of his shows, an American comedian. He once did a bit on how he went to a religious school and was not molested by priests, and this left him with a lifelong fear that he secretly wasn't attractive enough.
Yeah. He's the thing about that is that's funny because it's true.
Yeah. But he is... Because you're thinking about if someone like that did it, there wouldn't have been this, we're going to do it and we'll move on so no one is uncomfortable. There would have just been, and now we're just going to do this. And so Gervais, it may be slightly embarrassing, but it's less than these people deserve.
Yeah.
And also, as I said, I don't think it was terribly funny.
Anyway, I suppose we'll leave it there for the time being, and we hope that when this is actually going out, that the world is still there, and the Iranians haven't decided, well, the time has come to loose the beast, and we're all just wake up in a smouldering heap of Middle Eastern conflicts. It's a cheerful thought.
Because it would be terrible, Michael, and totally unprecedented for the Middle East to erupt into conflict.
Yes, you see, that's the worrying thing. When violence erupts in a place where you never expect it to.
We'd have nothing to go on.
Where it's a big surprise. Because let's face it, we know the Middle East is always going to be, we expect it at least, to be a calm, peaceful kind of place. Because it is the home of the world's three great monotheisms. Islam, which is the religion of peace. Christianity, founded by the Prince of Peace, and Judaism.
Well, it would be terrible to see the region that gave birth to those three great monotheistic religions going against the region that gave birth to the fourth.
Zoroastrianism.
No, the Disney Corporation.
Oh, indeed. All hail. Yes. Blessed be Mickey.
I might rephrase that a bit, Michael.
No, I'm happy with that.
I suppose you would. It suits your lifestyle.
No. Settle down. And on that note, I think I'll say good night and goodbye, and we'll talk to you soon.
All the best.